Good morning. I'm Bill, and I'm a miracle. And you know what? You are too. And I'd like for you to repeat after me. I am a miracle.
I am a miracle.
And I'm here to celebrate me. Good start. I'm Bill Sanders, and I am an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober this morning. And that is the single most important thing that I can tell you from this podium today, that it is by the miracle and the grace of a loving God that I have awakened for the last 12,334 mornings without a hangover. Now, I don't want you to spend the next hour trying to figure that out. So I'll go ahead and tell you that computes to July 26, 1982. And I can tell you this morning, that impresses me a whole lot more than it impresses you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one thing that Kent and Polly and I and all the other speakers this weekend share. We are cheerleaders for Alcoholics Anonymous, unashamed, unabashed, and happy for it every single day. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a fairly young man. I was 39 years old. Same age as Bill Wilson when he got sober. I'm an old man today. Next week I'll be 73 years old. And you may not believe it, but that's the oldest I've ever been. I love this journey. If I'd known it was going to be so much fun, I think surely I would have gotten here sooner. But I do know for a fact that it took every single drink that I had to make me teachable. A lot of people these days, and I have no problem with it, identify themselves by saying I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. But I still identify myself as Bill Sanders, a recovering alcoholic, because I am a work in progress. And I want to remain a work in progress until the last breath I take on this earth. As an alcoholic, if I feel like I have arrived, I've got it, then I'm in trouble. And I get indications of that fact every day that it's a miraculous program because, you see, I've got this book at home, it's blue. And it's a weird book. It's magical because I've read it a whole bunch of times, and every time I read it, they've rewritten that sucker. There is stuff in that book that was not there the last time I read it. I'm a highlighter, and I'm an underliner, and I mark things in my book. But I tell you, tomorrow I'll open that book up, and chances are very good I'll find something that was not there the last time I read it. I shared that from the podium at a conference in Northern California some years ago, and a little girl came up to me afterwards and said, "Do you really believe that?" I said, "Sweetheart, I'll tell you what I believe. I believe that God speaks to me through that book. I think he reveals to me what I need to see when I need to see it, which tells me that I need to pick that book up on a regular basis, because if I don't, I might miss a message. I also believe that God speaks to me through you people. I quite often say, I pray for God's will and go to a meeting to find out what it is. God's never spoken to me, as I said yesterday morning, but God's never spoken to me through a trumpet. He's never spoken to me through a burning bush. I did ask my first sponsor if a burning sofa counted, and he said it didn't. But he speaks to me through you people. I get my answers in the meeting rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, which behooves me to go to a lot of meetings. My sobriety date, as I said, is July 26, 1982, but that was not my first AA meeting. I'd been to a couple before that. The first one I had been to was about 5 years earlier than that. A friend of mine had invited me to go to an AA meeting with him. And I wanted to be supportive of my friend, so I went with him. Found out he had a little different motives, but we went to the meeting, and he had to explain to me everything that was going on. They read all that stuff at the beginning, and I didn't understand any of that. And then they opened it up, and people started talking, and they were telling things I didn't think I'd told if I'd have been them. They had weird, weird things that they laughed at. I don't think I laughed at some of what they were. But it really got confusing at the end of the meeting. This guy got up in front of the room and he called out Mary's name. And Mary stood up and people started whooping and hollering and clapping. And I'm saying, what is this? He said, oh, we're going to celebrate. This is Mary's 24th birthday. She looked a lot older than that to me. Well, they said a bunch of things about Mary, and then this guy who was standing up there put something in her hand. I said, what did he give her? He said, it's a poker chip. Okay. And then they brought out this little cake, and they gave that to her. And then my friend turned to me and said, Bill, if you won't drink for a year, we'll do this for you. I said, now let me get this straight. If I won't drink for a year, you'll give me a poker chip and a little cake. I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. I wish I'd stayed, but I didn't. I believe that I was born an alcoholic. I believe that the ism was in place from the first breath I took on this earth. At the age of 15, I mixed alcohol into the formula and began my journey into alcoholism. Now, my sponsor, Clancy, says, if your problem is alcohol, we got a real easy solution for you. Don't drink. But if your problem is alcoholism, and you take away the alcohol from an alcoholic, you better replace it with something, or you're going to have a basket case on your hand that will end up crazy, locked up, or dead. And I don't like any of those three alternatives. I believe that I was an alcoholic from day one because I always felt a little different from my peers. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. No matter how much in the middle I was, I felt like I didn't quite fit, I didn't quite belong. There was some missing it inside of me that I didn't have that made me different from other people. I didn't feel like I fit. Now, a few years ago, I went to my 50th high school reunion. It was kind of sad because none of my classmates were there. It's a bunch of old people. You could have asked those people, is that true that Bill didn't fit, didn't belong? And they'd say, no. Bill was in the middle of everything. He joined everything. It's true. I joined everything, church, school, scouts, you name it, I joined it and belonged to nothing. I had my first drink at the age of 15, but I need to tell you, before that, I went into the profession that was to be my profession for the next 50 years. In 1958, I became what purportedly then was the youngest disc jockey in America. The record's long since been broken, but back then it was supposedly a fact. And I spent 50 years in broadcasting until I retired about 10 years ago. And everybody assumed that the smart aleck kid they heard on the radio every afternoon from 4 to 7, spinning rock and roll records and bumping his gums, was who I was. They didn't know that I was that same scared little kid hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone in a closed studio, being somebody else. And I mastered that. For most of my life, until I came to this fellowship, I was a master chameleon. Who was I? Well, I was whoever I perceived that you wanted me to be. In any given hour, I could change politics. I could change philosophy. I could change religion. I could change everything I liked or disliked to do my very best to match you. And I did that to the extent that by the time I reached Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea who Bill Sanders was. I was lost. A lost soul with no guidance, no aim in life. As I said, I didn't have a drink until I was 15 years old, and a group of friends asked me if I wanted to. I grew up in a small town in northeast Georgia. If I wanted to go to South Carolina and buy some beer. Curiosity, peer pressure, I don't know, I said yes. And we crossed over the state line into South Carolina, and there was a little beer joint over there. You could pull up behind it and honk the horn. And if you could see over the steering wheel, they'd sell it to you. And we got, I think, what I remember is a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And we came back and sat on the banks of the Savannah River. You know, they say you ought to go back sometime to where you had your first drink. I can't do that. Because where I had my first drink is now at the very bottom, about 300 feet at the bottom of Lake Hartwell. I can get close, but I can't get to where I... And somebody took out a church key and popped open one of those beers and handed it to me. Now, I see some young faces in here. A church key ain't got nothing to do with a church. If you don't know what it is, ask your sponsor. Somebody handed me that beer, and I took a great big slug of it. And I remember it as though it were yesterday. That was the most vile, putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I'd ever put in my mouth. And that's probably why I only drank six of them that night. The taste was terrible. Excuse me. I don't need to tell you folks, though, what happened between the second and the third beer. If you're like me, you know what happened. Suddenly, little Billy Sanders wasn't afraid anymore. And in that moment, I became smarter, wittier, handsomer, sexier, even taller than I had ever been in my entire life. Or for that matter, anybody I'd ever known in my entire life. And in that moment, I thought, consciously or subconsciously, I have found a friend that's going to be my friend for the rest of my life. And tragically, it almost was. A belief was set in motion that night that I was to carry with me for a quarter of a century. And that belief is this. I believed that alcohol affected everyone who drank the same way it affected me. I know today it doesn't. That sort of explains some of the things that I don't understand about the people out there. For example, I will never understand the person that says, "No, no more for me, one's my limit." That's dumb. I've never wanted one of anything in my life. I live by the philosophy, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. But the one that really got me and still to this day gets me, and I will never understand these people, the people who say, "Nope, nope, no more for me, I'm beginning to feel it." That ain't where you quit. That's where you get going good. I don't understand those people. And you know what? Those people don't understand me. And they never will. And I have long since quit trying to make them understand. I frankly didn't think there would ever be anybody that would understand until God led me to you. I didn't drink that much in high school. I grew up in a very small town, as I said. And if my little Southern Baptist mama had caught me drinking, I wouldn't have needed Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd have needed an undertaker. But then I went off 40 miles from my hometown to this little city of Athens, Georgia, to college. And that's when my alcoholism began to blossom. Nobody cared how much I drank. Nobody cared whether I went to class or not. And I began to drink every day. And I'd like to share with you some of my fond memories of my years at the University of Georgia. I really would like to. By then, I was beginning to suffer from what folks up in my area of the country called they called them well, let's just say we call them blackouts. '61, that was a blackout. And that's all right, I'll wait. I stayed in trouble for 4 years at the University of Georgia, constantly in trouble. There was an old dean of men at the University of Georgia then for, gosh, over 40 years, and his name was Bill Tate. And Bill Tate, for some reason, took a liking to me, even though probably because I spent so much time in his office. You here again? What have you done now? For some reason, he took a liking to me, and he made the remark somewhere the first of my junior year. He said, "You're going to graduate from this place with a diploma in your hand if it's the last thing I ever do." And it doggone near was. I'll give you one little example. There's a grand tradition at the University of Georgia that any Georgia fans or Georgia grads here? Well, there's a grand tradition after every Georgia ball game victory, they start to ring the chapel bell in the tower at the chapel of the North campus. And they ring that bell until midnight. And it's an honor to be a bell ringer. There's a roster in the library at the University of Georgia that's been there for over 100 years. When you ring the chapel bell at 15-minute intervals after each game, they record your name in that roster. And it's there for all posterity. I rang that chapel bell. My name's not in that roster. Probably has to do with something, the fact that I was ringing the chapel bell at 3 o'clock in the morning on Easter Sunday. Now, in case you're not a football fan, the season's pretty well over by then. Those are the kinds of things that I did. I got hauled in by the dean one Saturday night when he came to the college infirmary and found me at 3 o'clock in the morning singing the Star Spangled Banner to the empty flagpole, waking up all the patients in the infirmary. I could always tell what Dean Tate's demeanor was when he got out of his old 56 Chevrolet and he had his pajama bottoms hanging out from underneath his trench coat. I knew I was in trouble, and he'd go, "You, my office, 8 o'clock. Get back in the car and take off." That got to be a habit. One Saturday night, my roommate and I were visiting in a friend's apartment in Athens. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning again, and we were 9 sheets to the wind. I had reached that point in my drinking where what I called my blithering idiot stage. The guy's apartment we were in had an antique gun collection hanging on his wall. He was real proud of it. He was insured for a ton of money, and he guarded that with his life. And I reached up on the wall, and I grabbed down an old long-barrel .22 pistol and waved it in the air and started acting like Matt Dillon or Wyatt Earp. I looked at my roommate and said, "Stick him up!" And he threw up his hands, and I squeezed the trigger. And in a moment, my roommate was lying on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. They were to tell me later that morning that my roommate would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet had severed his spine. A strange thing happened that next morning. My roommate reached up from a hospital bed and he put his hand on my arm and he said, "Bill, don't blame yourself. It was an accident. It could have just as easily been the other way around. Please don't blame yourself." He had forgiven me immediately. But I didn't forgive myself for more than 20 years because I didn't know how. It was not until you people handed me the message of the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, eighth, and ninth steps that I was able to find peace and to find forgiveness and to find relief. Instead, I used it as an excuse to crawl deeper into the bottle. As long as there was enough alcohol, I could make the voices quit. But the day came when there wasn't enough. And I decided to make my escape. So I went to the college infirmary for several weeks and amassed a supply of sleeping pills, telling them I was having trouble sleeping. And I waited till one Friday afternoon when my new roommate was headed home to show his brand new car he just bought to his family. And I watched him pull out of the parking lot. And I closed the drapes and I sat down on the side of the bed. And I emptied what was later determined to be between 50 and 60 sleeping pills on the nightstand. And one by one, two by two, I swallowed all of them down and turned out the lights and pulled up the cover. And for many years, I believed that it was a huge coincidence, what a word, that my roommate's brand new car, conked out at the city limits of Athens, had to be towed back to the dealership. And my roommate came back into that dorm, looked at me, saw the empty bottles, knew the frame of mind I'd been in, and called the ambulance. I use the word coincidence with the definition that I have since learned. I believe that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. I believe that was the first of many times that the God you people introduced me to looked down and said, "Big boy, I'm not through with you yet." When I say many times, with all the wrecked cars, the insane behavior that I lived for so many years, someone, somewhere, was watching over me. And I am thankful for that every day of my life. It was then decided that I needed some help. Now, when I go to speak in some parts of the country or when I speak in Canada, I have to explain the meaning of the word help. If you need help, that means you require some assistance. But I don't know if the definition holds in Ohio or not, but help, H-E-P, means you're in deep doo-doo. And I needed help. And it was then that I began my career of seeing shrinks. And over the period of years, I visited every kind of those individuals there were. Counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, psychological social workers, ministers, you name it, I went to see them and walked out of every one of their offices damning them because not one single one ever did one single thing to either help me or help me. Now, we got this thing around here called rigorous honesty. And that kind of forces me to admit that there is at least a remote possibility one of those people might have been able to help me if I had ever once told them the truth. Second, third question. Think you might have a problem with alcohol? Think you might have a drinking problem? No, I drink fine. And they go off treating something else. One of those shrinks I went to was a very famous shrink. he and his partner had had a patient, whatever you want to call it, that was very unique, and they had written a book about this woman, and the title of the book was The Three Faces of Eve. And right about the time I was seeing this doctor is when the movie The Three Faces of Eve came out. And it was about this woman who had three distinct personalities living inside her body. The movie won Best Picture. Joanne Woodward got Best Actress for that movie. And it's a classic. But I would ask my doctor all the questions I could about this woman with three personalities. Of course, with client-patient confidentiality, he wouldn't tell me much. But I wanted to know all I could, because I felt like if I could get my personalities down to just three, that I could handle it. You see, I have these meetings that go on up here in my head. I got this committee up there that they're always gabbing away. They try to say, oh, you ought to have a drink. You can handle that better if you just have a drink. Now, this is the part I always kind of dread, because I hate to tell you people this morning, but I have to. My committee don't like you. They want to keep me away from you. And I'm sorry to have to tell you that, but it's the truth. But you see, I like me better when I'm with you. You bring out the best in me. And that's why I spend so much time with you. That's why I love being around people like Polly and Kent and all the other people here this weekend. Those voices don't ever go away. But they get real quiet when I'm around you. And I don't listen to them much. As I said, I spent 50 years in broadcasting. I have a lot of wonderful memories of broadcasting, a few blackouts through there too. And a lot of wonderful experiences. I met a lot of wonderful people. I might have met a lot of famous people. I dined at the governor's mansion in the White House and interviewed presidents and some movie stars. I'll share just one brief memory. I was sent when I was working at WSB here in Atlanta. One day, the news director came in and said, grab your tape recorder, go downtown to the Henry Grady Hotel. You got to do an interview. I said, okay, who am I interviewing? He said, you're interviewing Lyndon Johnson. I said, oh, okay. And I grabbed a tape recorder, got in the mobile unit, and started downtown from White Columns. And on the way down there, I think, you know, there ain't no way in the world you can do this without a little fortification. So I stopped at one of my neighborhood water holes and had a couple of quick shots. Went down to the hotel, got on the elevator, went up to the designated floor. I was met at the elevator by the Secret Service and was frisked, and they checked my credentials, and they checked my equipment that I had with me. And then they ushered me into the parlor of this big hotel suite. And I was greeted at the door by this giant of a man who grabbed me by the hand and said, come on in, boy, and have a seat. And I went in, I sat down on a sofa, and he sat down on another sofa facing me. And I couldn't help notice on the coffee table between us, there was a couple of glasses and a jug of Jack Daniels. He said, before we do this thing here, let's have us a little snort. Sounded good to me. He poured my glass full and he poured his glass full. And I should tell you at this point, back then you didn't just walk in and sit down and interview the president. You had to do what was known as the pre-interview interview. And that's where you tell him what you're going to ask him, and he tells you whether or not he's willing to talk about that or not. Yes, no, that's fine, but no, let's don't talk about that. And as we're doing that, I'm taking a few sips, and every time I get about three swallows, he reaches over and fills the glass up again. A little while later, it started getting hot in there. A few more minutes, it hit me. My God, this man is drunker than you are. A few more minutes, he said, come on, turn that thing on, let's do it. And I turned on the tape recorder and started recording, and I asked some great questions. He had great answers. The interview went perfect until I got to a point where I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. Now, I can always figure out the age of the audience. Max, you're young, and you grew up in India, not here. Her name was Lady Bird, not Lady Bug. Thank God he thought it was funnier than y'all did. I had a lot of experiences like that, some of which I would share if I had time, and some no way. But the career was good to me, although I almost blew it. I almost drank away that career. And it is by God's grace, and you people in these rooms, that I was able to finish that career, as I said, for 50 years when I retired 10 years ago. And I owe to you the fact that my portrait hangs in the journalism school in Athens, Georgia, in the Georgia Broadcasting Hall of Fame, because you saved my life and made that possible. And I owe that to you, to my God, and to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the latter years of my career in broadcasting, I did a lot of entertaining. I did a lot of traveling. I always used to say I was scared of flying. I've since come to realize I never was scared of flying. What I was scared of was crashing. But I'd always get out to the airport early, go in the bar and have a few snorts before I get on the plane. If I do that, I didn't care where they went. And that worked great. Have a few drinks, go get on the plane, everything's cool. And it worked fine, except when I would forget to get on the plane. Now, a little interesting sideline here. For a number of years, our hometown airline, Delta Airlines, had an advertising campaign, an advertising slogan, that says, Delta is ready when you are. Some of you may remember that. The ironic thing is, I did the voiceover for that commercial on radio and television that ran all up and down the East Coast. And I had only one line in that whole commercial, and that was the closing line that says, Delta is ready when you are. That's a lie. They'll leave you. So I do what any good drunk would do. I just get on another airplane and go somewhere else. Call home that night. My wife says, how's the meeting in New York going? I said, I don't know. I'm not in New York. Where are you? I'm in New Orleans. More and more often, I was waking up in strange places, in strange cities, in strange beds with strange people. More and more often, my behavior was becoming more and more bizarre and unacceptable by any standard. And more often, I was feeling a loneliness, an isolation, that old feeling of not belonging coming back. You see, our disease is cunning, baffling, powerful, and sneaky. My alcohol was my best friend until it became my worst enemy. And in every one of our lives, there comes that day. And I've asked hundreds of people this. Do you know what day and time your disease whispered in your ear, gotcha? Because that's what happens. That's what happened to us. That day came where we had no control over alcohol. It became our master. And I don't know when that happened, but it did. I used to think I was a social drinker. I've learned that if you have to drink in order to be social, you are not a social drinker. I had a lot of bizarre behavior, as I said. I proved that you can't drive a car through a steel post on an Atlanta City street. I crashed, and the cops came, and they put those handcuffs on me and put me in that cage in the back of the cop car. And all the way to the police station, I'm telling this young rookie cop, "You're making the biggest mistake of your life. I'm not drunk. I've only had two beers. There ain't no way I'm drunk." He's ignoring me. And by the way, I'm convinced, you may not want to believe this, but I believe it. I believe that in the life of every alcoholic, at some time or another, when we're in a blackout, we're hauled off to this little school, and it teaches us one thing. If you're ever stopped by the cops, never admit to more than two drinks. You ever watch cop shows on TV? Guy falls out of the car, splat on the ground. "Well, you had a little too much to drink." "No, I just had two beers." A while back, we were watching that cop show on TV. This guy came out of the car, slid down the car, and bloop on the ground. Cop looked at him and said, "You had too much to drink, huh, fella?" He said, "No, I've only had three beers." I went, "Oh, God, he missed school." They took me into the police station, put me on that breathalyzer doohickey, and I blew in that thing, and it registered .28. Yeah, woo. I said, "Uh-uh, that can't be. There is no way in the world that I could be registering .28 on two beers." The cop agreed with me. I can tell you right now, it's the only thing we agreed on that night. And I'm going to give you a little advice in case you're not finished with your story, and I pray to God that you are. If you ever get arrested for DUI and you have to go to court, don't go to court drunk. Judges don't like it. I had a friend who's a lawyer who told me, "Bill, when you go into court, this is the first DUI, when they call your name and ask, how do you plead, you stand and say, 'Your Honor, I plead nolo contendere.'" And I said, "What is that?" He said, "That means you plead no contest." And he'll slap you on the wrist, give you a little fine, send you on your way. Got it. Well, needless to say, I had some fortification before I went to court that morning. I sat there for hours and hours, reading those names off. They ain't ever going to get to my name. They finally did. They called my name. "Mr. Sanders, how do you plead?" "Your Honor, I plead nimlo nirenjit. I plead nabob guilty." I couldn't remember that damn Latin to save my life. Along the way in our journey, I met a beautiful girl. I got married. A few years later, we were gifted from God by a beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-haired girl. The apple of Daddy's eye, and I was going to be the best daddy ever. But my disease had other plans. And for years, I will, the rest of my life, make living amends for the first 12 years of my little girl's life. When I would look at her, the only look that was ever in her eyes was a look of fear and of hate and of disgust. But you see, I had on what I've come to call my alcoholic blinders. They didn't allow me to see what I was doing to other people. See, I thought, this is my problem. If my problem, it's my problem. It doesn't affect you. Get out of my face. I thank God for the women and men of Al-Anon. I've learned so much from them. I've seen the mirror image of my disease, and I've seen the havoc that I wreaked in the lives of everyone who came in contact with me. My little girl even actually wrote in her diary one time, "I wish my daddy was dead, and maybe there'd be some peace in our home." I lived to drink, and I drank, I thought, to live. My wife and I reached the point where we no longer communicated. If I didn't come home for 3 or 4 days, she didn't ask where I'd been. She reached the point she didn't care. And likewise, I didn't care where she went and what she did. And one day I'm sitting in my recliner chair at home, and my wife leaves. I'm sitting there with my bottle in my hand, looking at the television. She's gone 2 or 3 hours, and she comes back and stands in front of me and said, "Guess where I've been?" And I said, "Who gives a, who cares?" She didn't say anything. She did something really weird. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked down at it, and I looked back at her, and I looked back at it again, and I said, "I don't know where you've been, but if that's all you won, you had a lousy night." Well, y'all can guess where she'd been. She had been to one of them A&A meetings. And she told me that, and I went into an absolute flying, pluperfect rage. Because I knew that that woman was not an alcoholic. No way. Because if she was an alcoholic, then she just couldn't be an alcoholic. That's just all there was to it. But you see, she didn't care what I thought. She just started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Some fool nonsense about 90, 90, and 90-something. And I'm at home waiting for the other shoe to fall. I'm waiting to, "You need this worse than I do. You're a bigger drunk than I am." Nope, not a word. Not a word. Oh, there were a few little hints left around the house, like I'd go in the bathroom and lift the toilet seat, and there's how it works, taped to the lid. That's the truth, isn't it? Finally, the other shoe did fall. She said, "I'm going tonight to pick up a 90-day chip, and I'd like you to be there." Uh-uh, no way, not going to happen, not in this life. A few tears, a few deals, and I went. On one condition, I'm going in my car so I can get away from there. She said, "Where are we going?" I said, "Where are we going?" She said, "We're going to a place called the 8111 Club. And I said, "Okay, follow you." And I followed her, and we turned up the driveway of this little house sitting up on the hill in a grove of trees. And I felt weird going up that driveway because I'd passed that house 100 times on the way home from the bar. And I'd look up there and think to myself, "Bill, you need to get to know the guy that lives in that house because he obviously has a party every night." Well, that night old Bill went to the party. I slipped down behind a post in the back of the room. And for the next hour, I witnessed the biggest bunch of weirdos I'd ever seen in my life. They read all that stuff. He got about through reading that stuff, and there's this guy waving his arm doing this, and I'm saying, "For God's sake, somebody tell that man where the bathroom is." They pointed to him, and he stood up and right out loud told him his name and that he was an alcoholic. And I'm thinking, I don't think I'd have told that if I'd have been him. And then he said he had gotten 3 DUIs. And you know what those people did? They busted out laughing. And I'll never forget the thought that went through my head of, why are these people laughing? Don't they know what they are? They're alcoholics. They've got nothing to laugh about. I tell you this morning, I thank God every day of my life for the laughter that we share in these rooms. Because there is magic and there is power. And there is healing in that laughter. And wherever I go, I tell people, if you don't have a home group that laughs a lot, go find one that does. I also like to caution newcomers. Don't laugh all the time or they'll come get you. Just word of caution. Meeting seemed like it lasted forever, and finally everybody stood up and said the Lord's Prayer, and I struck out across the parking lot, and I got halfway to my car. And something grabbed me by the shoulder that felt like a steel vise. Spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a man 7 feet, 11 inches tall. Make Kent look like a shrimp. I know tonight he was only 6'6", but he looked a heck of a lot taller that night. I also remember him from the meeting. He was a little bit different from the other people in the meeting. Most of them said, my name's Joe, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Russell, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Mary, I'm an alcoholic. This guy was different. When they called on him, he said, howdy, my name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk. Some of you may remember Floyd. Well, he grabs me by the shoulder and spins me around and starts talking to me. He starts talking about drinking moonshine up in the mountains and about his fifth grade education. And I'm thinking, dear God, why is that man telling me all this? He don't even know who I am. I found out later he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. And he's Floyd's going. Blah, 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 blah. People coming out and getting in their cars and going. Now, remember, I went in my own car so I can get out of here. My wife comes out, goes, bye, gets in her car and leaves. And then it's me and Floyd. He talked to me about his DUI he got driving the school bus. And he talked to me about falling down on the ground in the wintertime and face freezing to the ground, and they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. Now, I'm not hearing most of this because I'm busy making a deal with God. You know what deal. Well, Floyd talked on there for, oh gosh, I don't know, about 3 days. I finally got away from him, got in the car, went home, walked in the house. My wife started to say something. I said, don't open your mouth. Don't you ever try to get me back to that nut bin again. And she didn't. But the roller coaster ride continued down, down, down. The loneliness, the anxiety, the fear got worse and worse and worse. Till the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk, whole week missing. It's about 6 o'clock in the evening, and I'm sitting in my recliner chair when I came out of the blackout. And in my left hand, there's an empty bottle. And in my right hand, there was a fully loaded and cocked .22 pistol. And I had not remembered picking up either one of them. And the thought that went through my head was, is this all there is? Is this really all there is? Because if it is, you can have it. And through the fog of that Monday evening at twilight, there came a voice. The voice of God? Not exactly. Voice of an angel? Not really. It was the voice of a beautiful, wonderful, lovable, strapping, hillbilly drunk named Floyd. And the words that cut through that miserable Monday afternoon were simply this. Floyd had said, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was that day was any closer to hell on this earth, I hope I never know it. I got up out of my chair and I walked in the bathroom. I cleaned up as best I could. Drank a half, gargled a half a bottle of Listerine. Drank the rest. Now, for years, I didn't tell that part. Because I'm ashamed of it. I mean, I was a career alcoholic. And for my last drink to be Listerine, that's just disgraceful. But that's what it was. And I ain't going to go change it now. I got in the car and I drove back to that little house on the hill. And I got out of the car and walked in and slid behind that post at the back of the room. Now, I don't know about the God of your understanding, but the God of my understanding has a sense of humor. Because when I looked around that post at the front of the room, sitting there chairing that meeting, was my wife. She didn't see me until the end of the meeting when a man got up and explained those chips. If you're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I got up and took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed a white poker chip into my trembling, sweating hand. And I walked back and sat down. I choose today to believe that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away. Because as I said at the beginning, by the grace of God, and by the love and tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this, I haven't had a drink since that night. And I thank God every day of my life for that. The even greater miracle is not that I didn't take a drink, but that I haven't wanted to take a drink. You told me I needed to get a sponsor. I told you that's no problem at all. I'm in broadcasting. I got lots of sponsors. How about Delta? You explained that was not the kind of sponsor you were talking about. So I decided to do it scientifically. I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One I knew would pat me on the head every day and say, "Boy, you're working this program great." Took a few weeks, but I found him. Snow-white hair, roly-polier than I am, perpetual smile, wide, mile wide. And I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I knew I was in trouble that first night. "You betcha, I'll be your sponsor now. Let's discuss the rules." "Rules? Wait a minute, what rules?" "He's always very simple. You're going to roll out of that bed every morning onto your knees, and you're going to ask God, as you understand him, to keep you sober today. And the last thing you're going to do before you get back in that bed at night is you're going to get on your knees again, and you're going to say thank you." I said, "Well, now, Doc, let me tell you. I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. Church doors opened, we were there. And I know y'all believe in prayer, and so do I. But I have to be honest with you. I'm not comfortable with that knee business." He said, "I didn't say a damn thing about you being comfortable." Well, you know, you couldn't talk to me like that. I had almost 30 days. I said, "Doc, I thought this was a program of program of suggestion." He says, "It is. I suggest you do what I tell you or get you another sponsor." That's how we started. Then he gave me that book, and God, was he a fanatic about that book. Every little thing that would come up in my life to ask him a question about, "Well, what step are you using on it?" "Oh, Doc, this ain't got nothing to do with steps. I'm talking about real life stuff here." He said, "Go look again." Over and over and over again. "Go look again. Go look again." And finally, in this thick skull of mine, I got the answer that I needed, that there is nothing, nothing, absolutely nothing that is going to happen in the life of this alcoholic, that the answer is in that book and in those steps. And that book also taught me, as I said yesterday, that what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. That is both a promise and it is a warning. As long as I stay connected to the God of my understanding, and as long as I stay close to you people, I'm safe. I've got permanent remission from a fatal disease. How could anybody ask for more? I think it's one of the greatest gifts that God has ever given to mankind. I have a very hard time, and I don't think I ever will understand, somebody saying, "God, this has been a great gift, but I'm going to give it back to you. I just had too much fun drinking. I'm going to give this gift back to you. You give it somebody else." You know, I'm grateful that that thought never occurred to me. We say in this fellowship, talking about miracles, don't quit before the miracle happens. As I shared in the workshop yesterday morning, I changed that slightly. I say don't quit before the first miracle happens. Because you see, they never stop. The miracles keep coming and coming and coming and coming. As my grand sponsor, Bill Hollingsworth, was fond of saying, if you work the steps, you can't stop the promises. They're coming. Fasten your seatbelt. And I've done that. And every one of those promises have come true, most of them very early in my sobriety. When I was 3.5 years sober, in November of 1985, my sponsor Doc went on a 12-step call and never came home. As he and another man tried to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young man that Doc had been trying to keep sober, Doc caught the blast full in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. He gave his life doing what he'd rather do than anything on this earth, trying to save the life of an alcoholic. That evening, I sat in his den, and I felt a loneliness come over me that I hadn't felt in a long time. How can I go on? How can I stay sober without the man who planted me in this program, who dragged me through these steps, without the man who kicked my behind when I needed it and who put his arms around my shoulder when I needed it, and he was seldom ever wrong? How can I go on? In the quiet stillness of the evening, that answer came. I do it by doing what he taught me to do. And what his sponsor before him taught him and his sponsor before him taught him. All the way back to that fateful night on May 11th, 1935, when the broken-down stockbroker and the has-been doctor looked at each other in that gatehouse at the Cyberling Estate and said, do you think we might stay sober if we help one another? What a gift. You know, God could have looked down and treated us with any number of several ways. He could have said, they're a scourge in society, let them die. As many of us did. He could say, they're irreparably harmed, just lock them up and throw away the key. As many of us were and should have stayed. He could have said, let's put them in colonies like lepers, so they can't contaminate the rest of the world. But he did none of those things. Instead, he gave us each other. And with that, he gave us more love and more laughter and more joy and more happiness than most of us could have ever dreamed of in 1,000 lifetimes. And I believe, personally, I believe he did one more thing. I believe he gave us a one-on-one relationship with him that few people on this earth will ever know. I think we're the luckiest people in this world. And I cherish my gift, and I will never, with God's help, give it back. Now, for the next year and a half, I did something I do not recommend. I repeat, I do not recommend. For the next year and a half, I sponsored myself. And it took a year and a half for it to dawn on me that I had a fool for a sponsor and an even bigger fool for a sponsee. As Kent shared so eloquently yesterday, I believe in sponsorship. I need a sponsor today as much as I did in July of 1982, if not more. You see, I am still perfectly capable of conning myself. If I keep a thought up here in my head, there is absolutely nothing I can't rationalize. But then I pick up the phone and I call my sponsor. Let me tell you what I've been thinking. Now, about two-thirds of the time, I get halfway through and go, never mind. Because I hear the words coming out of my mouth and I realize how stupid it sounds. And thank God, my sponsor, if I get all the way to the end, won't mind telling me that that's stupid. As I told you, I love being a miracle. But almost as much as that, I love getting to participate in somebody else's miracle. I love being a part of someone else coming from the ground up, through the steps, through the fellowship, through the love, through the book. I love doing that. And I've been fortunate enough to participate in a lot of miracles through the years. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I tell people I sponsor a lot of men because that's how many I need to help keep me sober. And I've been fortunate with several of them. I'm going to share just very quickly one guy that I sponsored and have sponsored for over 20 years. And some of you in this room are going to know him. This was a young African-American man who came up to me 20-some-odd years ago. And he is the same height as Kent here. And he said, looked down at me and said, "I need a sponsor." I went, "Okay." And I found out in the next few days that the young man had been an alcoholic, a drunk, a dope dealer on the streets of Atlanta and Fulton and DeKalb counties. And he had gotten arrested when he tried to sell a stolen car to an undercover cop. Didn't say he was real smart. Of course, he was arrested, hauled into DeKalb County court, and tried, sentenced, served some time. And in court, he was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd come out, and he asked me if I would sponsor him. And I told him yes. And not long after that, he said, "You know, I quit college to go with my career in alcoholism and drugs. I think I'm going to go back and finish college." And I said, "That's admirable. Do it." And he went back and he got his college degree. And then he said, "You know, I like helping people. I think I'm going to go to law school." That's a lofty goal, but go for it. He went to law school and he finished. He went to work for a prestigious law firm in Decatur. A few years after that, he and one of his partners split off from that firm and started their own law firm. 5 years ago, that young man was appointed as a judge in the same courtroom where he had been sentenced. And 3 years ago, he was licensed to practice law before the United States Supreme Court. And he took that case to the Supreme Court, and he won. Now, about all of us as miracles, I say of this young man, you can't get here from where he came from but by the grace of God. And I think that can be said of most of us. If we'll look at our innermost selves, at what we used to be and what we are today, you know, Kent said it well. First 2 or 3 years, every time I'd go and pick up a new annual, birthday chip, I would thank people and all that. But in reality, I was saying, "Look what I've done. Look how far I've come." Today, I can honestly look back and see how very little I had to do with it. I showed up, and you and God and this fellowship did the rest. Now, as I said yesterday, I've had wonderful sponsors. The first sponsor was Doc Crandall. My second sponsor was a wonderful, loving man by the name of Dr. Paul O. In case the name is not familiar to you, perhaps page 417 in the big book is. He is the one who penned the words, "Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today." In the last 10 years of his life, that man was my sponsor. And I learned so much from him about acceptance of myself and of the world around me. I accepted that life happens and that I've got a toolbox that's perfect for dealing with it. My third sponsor was a man named Hoyt Allison, one of the sweetest, dearest men in this world, who gave and gave and gave to people in AA. My fourth sponsor was a man named Dick Martin, Bellevue, Nebraska. Dick Martin was a giant of this fellowship. He put on conferences. He sponsored over 100 men. And I lost him last summer to to Parkinson's disease. And so I called and I asked his sponsor if he would take me on. And my sponsor for the last year has been the man by the name of Clancy Emmerslin. Clancy has 57 years in this program. Next year he'll be 90 years, or later this year he'll be 90 years old. He still travels the world over, and I mean literally all over the world, sharing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Up to as many as 40 and 45 weekends a year, he's in the air on an airplane going somewhere, sharing his story. I am grateful to all of those men who took the time out of their lives to sponsor me, not to tell me what to do, but to show me what to do and how to do it. I believe in sponsorship. I love being a miracle, and I love being a part of other men's miracles as well. And I, in closing, tell you why I love this fellowship so much. I had a marriage that was on the rocks. Three, not one, two, but three marriage counselors said, "Give it up. Your marriage is hopeless." But you see, God had other plans. And in December of 1982, on the day the divorce papers were to have been signed, my wife and I stood before the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier, and we renewed our vows, and we started all over again. And through God's grace and your help, come December of this year, we will celebrate 50 years of happy ever after. The woman I tried my best to get rid of, I can tell you today, is my best friend, my lover, my soulmate, and my pal. And I'd rather be with her than anybody on the face of this earth. We're both retired now, and we're together virtually 24 hours a day, and I wouldn't trade anything for it. The little girl who wrote in my diary, "I wish my daddy was dead." Today I have a wonderful relationship with my daughter. She's in her mid-40s now. But the day she got married, she told me, "Dad, I want to have the first dance with my new husband, but I want to have the second dance with you." Well, I cried all the way down the aisle in the church when I gave her away. And I told my daughter, I said, "Honey, tell me what music we're going to dance to, because I want to practice a little bit with your mom, because, you see, I don't dance nearly as well today as I never did." But she said, "No, not going to tell you. Be a surprise." Well, I watched as the young princess and prince had their first dance together. And then my little girl came and stood in front of me, and she reached out her hands. And I looked into her eyes, and instead of fear and hate and disgust, I saw love and I saw respect. And she led me out onto the dance floor, and the music began. And the words of the song were, "Did you ever know that you're my hero and everything I want to be? I can fly higher than an eagle. You're the wind beneath my wings." Dear God, what a miracle had been worked in the lives of this family that had been ripped and shredded and torn apart by the relentless, insidious, unforgiving disease called alcoholism. And yet, step by step, meeting by meeting, prayer by prayer, sponsor by sponsor, you, God, and AA had put this family back together again. That's why I'm grateful. That's why I thank God every day of my life for you and for this fellowship. So it can't possibly come as a surprise, or it shouldn't, that I would conclude this morning by doing two things. One, thanking Russell and Bill for a wonderful weekend, meeting a lot of old friends and a lot of new ones, getting to spend time with Kent and with Polly. But what I would close with is simply this. Did you ever know that you are my heroes? You're everything I've ever wanted to be. And together, I believe that we can all soar like eagles because He's the wind beneath our wings. Thank you, and God bless you.